Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
With the post-Super Bowl blues, as you well know, most of America is in a depression today from too much beer, pretzels, and whatever. And people are talking about the game to a certain extent and Clint Eastwood's halftime Super Bowl ad, because it was astonishing for a man who was allegedly somewhat conservative, or who knows what anyone really is anymore today, to be talking about bailing out the auto industry for a couple of reasons. First of all, there's a lot of lies in Eastwood's, and I'm a huge fan of Clint Eastwood. I've been for years, but he's wrong. Obama bailed out Chrysler, right? And we're told that Chrysler repaid the loan. But if you read the fine print, Chrysler did not repay the loan. Chrysler ran off with $1.4 billion not repaid, and it was Fiat who really made that $1.4 billion in tax dollars, your money. It was Fiat. Now, who owns Fiat? If you follow the money from the Democrat bailout of Chrysler all the way back to who owns Chrysler, you'll see the money goes back to Italy. And I'll stop the discussion at that point because there's a limit to what I can do on the radio. And so, therefore, the Obama administration gave $1.4 billion to people in Italy to bail out Chrysler. And so for Clint Eastwood, well, listen to Clint Eastwood. Tell me what you think.
It's halftime. Both teams are in their locker room discussing what they can do to win this game in the second half. It's halftime in America, too. People are out of work and they're hurting. And they're all wondering what they're going to do to make a comeback. And we're all scared because this isn't a game. The people of Detroit know a little something about this. They almost lost everything. But we all pulled together. Now Motor City is fighting again. I've seen a lot of tough eras, a lot of downturns in my life, times when we didn't understand each other. It seems that we've lost our heart at times. The fog of division, discord, and blame made it hard to see what lies ahead. But after those trials, we all rallied around what was right and acted as one.
Okay, and... oh, okay.
We find a way through tough times, and if we can't find a way, then we'll make one.
Okay. And?
All that matters now is what's ahead.
And?
How do we come from behind? How do we come together? And how do we win?
All right, there it is. I have no idea what the ad is about, other than he seems to be extolling the auto bailout, which was a bomb. First of all, the Chevy Volt is exploding. No one's buying them. That's number one. Number two, Obama bailed out Chrysler, and Chrysler was bailed out by, basically bought by Fiat for nothing down. And Fiat won $1.4 billion and not paying back the investment. The Treasury Department sank $12.5 billion into Chrysler in 2009 to help prop up the auto giant. Italian automaker Fiat purchased the government's 6% stake in the company last year, closing the books on the government's involvement. So all in all, the U.S. lost $1.3 billion on its investment. This is very ironic. I mean, this is a small-scale deal. Is that Eastwood is a Republican who opposed the bailout of the industry. Now, okay, let's just forget it. No one cares about that. Let's go to Madonna. Play the Madonna song. Then we'll talk about other trivial things on the Savage Nation. Because...
sexy.
I actually thought of the Muslim Brotherhood for a certain... I said that if they were running for a candidate here in America, they might have gotten about 10 million converts. after watching Madonna on the stage at the Super Bowl. This country is so degenerate that if Madonna can still have the audacity to get up there and think that somebody cares about her, it's astounding. Astounding to watch it. Then she brought in the lowest gutter rats from England who gave America the finger during the mid-break. And NBC, of course, did nothing about it because NBC Universal, as you well know, is owned by General Electric, which pays no taxes to the Obama administration on the General Electric income overseas. There's no money paid to the U.S. government. So that's why you never hear GE mentioned when you're talking about fairness and taxes. That's already topic two down the tubes, and it's only 12 minutes after the hour. Let's throw the whole wad at the audience here. Let's go. See, I know it's like Monday at the zoo. The Savage Nation knows after 16 or 17 years in radio what happens after the Super Bowl. It's normally a day I don't come on the radio. Either we do a best of or we get a fill-in because people are dull. They're completely tired. They're hungover. There was a famous story about zoos on Mondays. The animals, particularly the chimps and the other primates, would be exhausted on Monday. They wouldn't move because people threw them candied popcorn and candy on Sundays. The animals ate the sugary food and had a hypoglycemic attack on Monday. And that's what America is having today, the day after the Super Bowl. So therefore, let's go to the politics. As you know, from Blue Monday to Zoo Monday, very funny. I have a book coming out soon called Trickle Down Tyranny. It's a very important book, probably my opus, my best nonfiction, and I think it will be my last nonfiction book ever. I don't want to do anymore. There's nothing more I can say after this one. And it's not for sale, but I'll tell you what's frightening. Obama is a tyrant. Obama has stolen our constitutional rights from the day he began in office. And Obama, if he should win again, will turn this country into we don't know yet what the model is. Is it Beijing? Is it Venezuela? Where is this? What model is he using to transform this country? Here is a man who has such a hatred for this country's freedoms that we have no idea where we're going to end up with him. So listen to clip one now very carefully. It's 19 seconds, and you will hear why I say we have a tyrant in the White House.
What's frustrated people is that I have not been able to force Congress to implement every aspect of what I said in 2008. Well, you know, it turns out that our founders designed a system that makes it more difficult to bring about change than I would like sometimes.
So our founding fathers designed a system that makes it more difficult to bring about change than he would like sometimes. Well, all dictators would like to have instantaneous change, and so he's no exception. That's why the dumb old white male founding fathers who designed this system, designed it because they knew that the day would come that tyrants or would-be tyrants would assume the highest office and would try to take over the country. That's exactly why it's difficult to change the system, Mr. Obama. You should know that as a genius on the Constitution. 1-800-449-8255, that's topic number four, down the tubes, boom. So we've gone through, let's see, Obama on being president, tyrannical, Clint Eastwood's ad. Okay, this is already 15 minutes after. Yeah, let's try topic number four. I told you Dustin Hoffman in the HBO series Luck was so astonishingly bad the first time about the racetrack that I was astounded that it got produced. But then I said this is a product of a circle, an inner circle that doesn't listen to anybody, along the lines of Obama and Michelle and Susan Rice and the mother-in-law, who listen to nobody, apparently. And they are running a country as though it's a TV show. Well, HBO makes series for themselves and for the Hollywood hypocrites. I call it Hollywood, by the way. It hasn't been stolen yet by anybody, which is shocking. But Hollywood lives in its own void. And so they create this horrendous show called Luck, which I watched again last night because I was bored and I wanted to see if it got any worse, and it did. There again was Dustin Hoffman again trying to be a gangster. I could not believe it. He looks comedic. He waddles instead of walks. Now, what kind of man as a gangster could provoke respect in another man if he waddles from chair to chair? He doesn't walk. Dustin Hoffman waddles, if you look at it. He waddles like a penguin. Now, do you actually believe that a man, even if he's diminutive in size and a mastermind of crime, would marshal respect in tough guys, murderers, jewel thieves, hustlers, bondsmen, politicians, jello eaters, if he waddled around the room? I don't think so. So now let's listen to the comedic Dustin Hoffman. Actually, by the way, tough guys, I say to myself, do they have any idea how comedic this looks? It looks like a cartoon. I couldn't believe my eyes. But by the way, the other actors are very good in it. The worst acting in Luck is by opposite him, who actually lives in the apartment with him in this series, if you could believe it. He's allegedly his driver and bodyguard, but they look like they have a committed relationship to me. I mean, frankly, I don't know what the implication is. What is this, a committed relationship between Dustin Hoffman and that actor whose name I've always, Dennis Farina? I've never seen anything like that. Are they trying to do like La Cage au Chicago? So let's listen to clip one now with the astonishing disaster of Dustin Hoffman once again, trying to be a gangster. Listen.
Mike starts using my co-op to stash his dope. And my grandson's doing what he's doing. He's swinging from the chandelier with six broads. And then someone upstairs, a neighbor, whatever, drops a dime, and they bring the canines. They find a stash, 6 kilos of cocaine. You couldn't send them out to buy 6 pounds of dog food the shape he was in 4 years ago.
Well, the feds had to know.
Of course they knew. They want me to roll over on Mike and his offshore b-. I roll over on Mike or the kid takes the fall.
Well, the question is this. After you take door number 3, where you claim the dope and you do the time, the question is, Ace, what if it was all turned around?
And the answer is, Mike would have given me up in a heartbeat. So what? I never ratted on anybody in my life. And I wouldn't do it even with that.
I don't know why you wouldn't let me kill that.
Stop it. Stop it.
Hypothetic, I'm saying. Hypothetic.
It's enough. And it's hypothetic.
This is beyond belief. I have never seen anything like this. I mean, I'm not a film director, but even an amateur in a high school film directing class would say, wait, guys, okay, let's cut the scene. You're actually supposed to be tough guys. You're not supposed to be aging actors who are playing tough guys. You're not supposed to look like two guys in La Cage aux Folles. This is supposed to be actual tough guys talking. So let's start it again, okay? I'll be right back.
Savage.
So there it is. I gave you 5 topics and we got a dead show already. No, I mean, look. I understand post blues, the football blues. How can you top a guy catching backwards and holding on to a ball like that and not having a broken spine or a hand? They are supermen. I mean, these guys are amazing. Could anyone explain to me, by the way, I know I'm going to get an answer on this. I'm not a sports fan. Okay, I've told you that. But who? You got to watch the Super Bowl, otherwise you can get arrested by the Department of Homeland Security as being un-American. I understand that. So I watched the game for fear I'd be arrested on Monday by not talking about it. What was that thing about the guy who ran to the thing and sat down? Does anyone explain? What was that? One of the New York Giants did an amazing run right through the New England Patriot line, runs through them like the Red Sea parted, and he sits down on the goal line waiting for something. I didn't understand this. I felt as though I were a Martian watching a game. I didn't understand what he was doing. What was that? Is there a sports listener in the audience? Of course there has to be sports listeners. You can finally come out of the closet now and admit that although you listen to the Savage Nation, you're a sports nut. Because I know it's a big crossover audience. I understand that. So that's it. But this La Cage aux Luck, I have to go back to this. How does Dustin Hoffman get up in the morning and shave himself without hurting himself? Well, okay, that's why the electric razor was invented for Hollywood in particular. The reason the electric shaver was invented was specifically for men like Dustin Hoffman. There's no question about it, because there's no way that this man can't understand how awful the show is. La Cage aux Luck. By the way, I saw a good movie. They sent it to me. Joe Carnahan wrote it and directed a great movie called Luck. Called Gray. It's with my favorite actor, Liam Neeson, but if he converts to Islam, I'll never watch any of his movies again. I'm telling you right up front. I'm not gonna go down that road with him. He wants to go there, God bless him. Let him become. But I'm not going to watch his movie. Till he converts, though, I have to say I love this guy's acting. He plays an oil rig worker in the Alaskan outback. See, now they're calling. The game, I knew, would get it. He plays a guy who works in the Alaskan oil rig with the other, you know, guys who work up there. They're basically outcasts, ex-cons, running from this, running from that. Real tough guys working in the area of the Bering Sea. Really bad scene. So they all, and his job, he plays a wolf hunter who kills wolves with a sighted rifle, telescopically sighted rifle, to keep the wolves at bay from attacking the oil workers, okay, which is an interesting plot to begin with. He gets on an aircraft with the workers who are going back into civilization to Anchorage from way north in Alaska, you know, and the plane crashes. By the way, the plane crash is the best I've ever seen. The last great plane crash in the movie business was where the UPS, FedEx plane crashes and the guy winds up on an island, the actor who's a super liberal who I never watched because of it, whatever. He played a good role in it, but I won't watch his movies. I forget his name, honest to God. Huh? Tom Hanks, right. Remember, he crashes and he's on an island. But the plane crash in that was incredible. This is better because this is really better. It's everyone's worst nightmare. And he winds up in the wilderness, and there's seven survivors of the plane crash, and they band together to try and save their lives with nothing but what's in the plane crash. And the wolves are circling them the entire time. The only problem with it was I was given a media copy to watch at home, which I did after the Super Bowl game. And my name, M. Savage, was embossed on the DVD from the beginning to the end. I almost went blind trying to see the movie. They, like, emboss it in light letters so you can't bootleg it. I would never bootleg a movie. They should know that by now. I guess people do. You can't watch it, especially a movie with so much white in it, like snow scenes. And I'm looking behind my name, M. Savage. I got a kick out of it that my name was up in lights. I mean, I thought I was, like, famous for a minute. It was like the movie was gray by M. Savage, the acting by M. Savage, directed by M. Savage, cinematography by M. Savage. Everybody in the movie was named M. Savage. But the wolf thing, the computer-generated, the wolf thing was very well, was frightening, the growls. They growl like, how much does a wolf weigh? A full wolf in the wilderness. How much do those things weigh?
Savage.
I was too much TV. I watched the Super Bowl, most of it. Then I edited my book for an hour. My eyes almost blew out because I got new eyeglasses. They're too strong. I mean, they're perfect because my vision, you know, changed. But they're like magnifying glasses. And I'm through. It was like blind. Then I go back to the Super Bowl. Then after the Super Bowl, I go, did I watch the other? No. Then I went to dinner to a Japanese restaurant. I ate like I thought I'd eat healthy. I was sick all night from it. Me and my food. I have such a food thing. It's getting awful. I'm going to wind up eating applesauce and pablum. I go to a Japanese restaurant saying, I'm tired of eating heavy foods, too much salt. So I order like the appetizer, like, you know, a grilled whatever. What's the green? Leek. Grilled leek with hoisin sauce and grilled this. Oh, wonder, everything wonderful, miraculous. And I ordered soba soup because I know buckwheat noodles are anti-cancer. I know the anti-cancer properties of buckwheat, you know, goes back to the Europeans who used to eat buckwheat. And the Jews call it kasha. Kasha is a phenomenally, it's a great health food. And you don't really eat it anymore. No one knows what buckwheat is anymore. But the Japanese make a noodle called soba. Okay, but it's got to be buckwheat soba as opposed to the, like, chicken noodle soup soba, like white wheat noodles. And I ate that. I thought I was doing myself a favor. You know, I wasn't going to drink. So all night long, I felt like I had acid reflux from it. It was so healthful that I was sick all night. This is the problem. You can't change it. I would have been better off with my normal meal. But anyway, I think I came back. Then I watched the movie. Right. That's what I did. Then I watched the movie Gray with the wolves in it, with Liam Neeson attempting to survive. I won't give it away because it leaves you so limp. The howling of the wolves got my dog so scared, Teddy ran out of the living room. You know, I got the six speakers there. It's an older system, but it's awesome with a monster screen. I put it in 10 years ago. It was like 10 years ahead of its time. And bingo, Teddy goes running out of the room, scared to death of the wolves. It was like, oh. So I said, easy does it. So, I, you know, after the movie was over, I was so high on television, I needed more television. I became like a crack addict. There was not enough TV. I mean, so I had to go watch more TV. So I watched Luck, the end of it. And that's when I watched Dustin Hoffman making a putz of himself, like Lacazio Fowl, the two of them. You got the wolf sound. Let me hear the wolf sound. Playing it already. Okay. Radio is sound. Okay, that's all you got for me? I mean, no, the movie has wolf sounds that scare you. That we've heard, the ow, 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 ooh thing. But this one had a roar. They look like bears. They look bigger than they are. I mean, a wolf can weigh up to 165 pounds. That's the record. I looked it up already. I'm a genius. Normally it's 150 pounds. How do wolfhounds bring down wolves? What guts they have. My friend in an Irish bar had an Irish wolfhound. I love Fee, and he died a number of years ago. They lived to six. How could you get a dog that they're like a person? The dog was 165 pounds. He was like a man in the bar. You know what I'm saying? You got to know him. How you doing, man? You say hello to the bar owner and hello to the dog. I mean, this dog had a head on him. It was beyond belief. But they hunt wolves in packs, right? That dog was always like dirty from laying like in the dirt of the bar. One day I was there one summer. I haven't been there in years. I don't hang out in bars anymore. A dog went by in the street like a poor woman, like an old hippie woman in North Beach, like with a gray, like one of those red labs, you know, like an innocent kind of lib dog. This thing soared from inside the dark bar. He loped out of that bar. He ran down the street. Looked like four lopes. He was, you know, he didn't hurt it, but wow, what instincts they have. But he's dead already. How did like six of them hunt down a wolf? What nerve they must have to hunt down a wolf. What guts. Wolves are amazing creatures. I mean, I tell you, after watching this movie, I have a new respect for my dog. In fact, after the movie, I had to hold my dog and tell him it was okay, and there were no wolves in the house. But I looked at him differently because I realized my little friend is part wolf, descended from wolf. As you well know, all dogs descend from the wolf, which is why we're amazed at them, how some of them are so domesticated. But we know inside lurks, right? Inside the dog lurks a bit of the wolf. You push even a poodle around, a little one, he can rip your hand off, right? So I started calling my little friend a wolf-a-doodle after this. Because people ask me, what kind of dog is that? Because I don't trim him. They don't believe it, like it's a poodle, because he looks like a bear. If you don't trim a poodle, they look great. And you trim them, they look a little fussy, you know, and trimmed out. But, you know, so Teddy he's gray and he has full hair. So now I call him my wolf-a-doodle because he accidentally bit a family member last summer. By accident, he was sleeping on his back. I was watching TV. I was in Florida, right? And he was asleep. I mean, they go into a deep sleep. There's an adage, let sleeping dogs lie. There's a reason for that. There is a reason for certain adages. Well, in this case, the adage was 100% right. A family member who I love more than myself comes into the bedroom as dad, me, is watching TV with the clicker and the dog. And he comes from behind while the dog is backwards and goes to give him like a hug. And the dog snaps and almost tore his lip off. It was frightening. I had to smack him with the TV thing to stop the jaw. I said, well, are you crazy? You're my little dog. What are you doing? He didn't know what. It was instinct. It was pure instinct. So now we come back to the news of the day. Obama on being president. He wants to let the wolf out. He wants to let the wolf within come out. And he says our founding fathers designed a system that makes it more difficult to change than he would like. Okay, so he's trying to show that there's teeth behind the sheep. As you well know, he didn't become president because he's a meek guy. And he didn't become president because he's not brilliant. And he didn't become president, you know what I'm saying? So inside every politician, there's a wolf. You know, of course, in the case of Gingrich, there's no wolf on the inside. It's another type of animal, which we don't have to make fat jokes. He's already finished. It's over. God, please leave. Why don't you stop already? Let Mr. Nice Guy take the fall for the Republican Party. Okay, so we can watch the disaster, the bloodbath, when Mr. Nice goes up against the wolf Obama, because you know what's coming. We know already. We can all foresee it. Anyone who plays chess, checkers, backgammon, horseshoes, whatever game you play, you can see the end of this game already. It's in sight. The Republicans have set up another loser to lose to Obama, just as they did with McCain. Why? Because old Doc Savage told you the way the game is played. The parties that run the country have played a game now for a while, which is 8-8. They get 8, then the other guy gets 8. 8 Clinton, then 8 Bush. Then 8 this Democrat. Then 8. So Obama's only had half a term to them. The Democrat gang gets to rape the Treasury for 4 more years, while the Republicans sit in the background braying, oh, small government. We're for small government. And
What else are we for? Small government. I mean, it's like Beavis and Butthead. Well, what exactly do you stand for? Small government. Let the poor starve. Don't help anybody. That's our program. Help nobody. Let them all starve to death. Kick the illegal aliens out. That's just starting to sound like, man. What do they stand for? You haven't heard the word family values. Did a show on that last week. You'd think Republicans would at least push family values. Nothing, not a word, zero. It's like a cesspool out there. They don't see an opportunity. Drugs, out of control. Nothing, not a word about drugs penetrating every aspect of American society. Unnatural for a Republican candidate. Not a word about the pornography epidemic in America. Unnatural for a Republican candidate. Well, Mr. Romney, what do you think about pornography? I mean, at this point, all I can do is sit back and just watch the whole world slide into a disaster zone. So here we are. I know wolves go up to 109. I got the natch, and the wolf of the max is 165 pounds, according to this thing. But there's a jaw on that thing, the jaw, the head. And it says they Mackenzie Valley wolves are not the most successful in killing moose. When preying on medium to large-sized animals such as caribou and elk, pack members will in turn chase an ill or disadvantaged prey and wait until they tire. Now the Obama administration could turn Romney into a wolf and say that he's basically chasing the ill and disadvantaged Americans and waiting until they tire, and then they're going to tear away at them and let them die. They will then slowly start to tear away at the prey, attacking the flanks, the muzzle, the neck, and the hindquarters. That's the part I don't like. I mean, I know they have to kill, but, you know, can't they go to, like, Democrat PC school on how to kill the prey? They have to tear out his behind. I don't like that part. I've seen big animals go down. It can rip you. It makes you sick. But they're animals. I mean, they're not Democrats. Prey usually die from disembowelment. Yeah, they tear out their guts. And that's what the wolves do. That's what they do. Why do you do that, Mr. Wolf? Because I'm a wolf. Why don't you kill them humanely? Because I'm a wolf. Well, is there no other way you can kill other than tearing out his behind and ripping out his guts from his anus? I'm a wolf. That's what we do. We tear out their muzzle, and then we tear out their behind. And then we rip out their genitals. And we like to see them bleed out on the ground because we are wolves. That's what they would say to you if they could talk. They can't help it. They haven't yet been brainwashed into becoming U.S. military members. For example, this got me crazy. On my website, michaelsavage.com, I have a story. 8 sailors are thrown off a ship, which I've been on, the Bonhomme Richard. Why? Because they hold wrestling matches with new members who come aboard the ship. And they wrestle the guy out till he fainted. So right away, the PC feminists and the men without you-know-what who are now running the Navy said, we're throwing all these 8 guys out of the Navy because they wrestled a man into submission. So my headline is, 8 sailors thrown out of the U.S. Navy for being too manly. Yeah, right, they say. We have a zero-tolerance policy on hazing. Where did that come from? What do you mean by hazing? They're showing the guy that the guy's in the military and we wrestle and we want to be tough. That's hazing, you schmucks, you? You're destroying the greatest Navy the world has ever seen. You're making it incapable of defending us, you bastards, you. You have no idea what this does to me to see who took over the military. At every turn, fat-behinded feminists, degenerates of every kind running the military, telling men who are men not to be men. I hope you bleeped some of that out. No, I hope you didn't. I don't care what. Nothing bleeped out. When I need you to bleep, you don't bleep. I can't believe what I'm watching here. So this is why I'm saying the world is inside a movie. You can see anything anywhere, whatever you do. So as I say, Obama is a wolf pretending to be a sheep. And Romney is a sheep pretending to be a sheep. So who wins that fight? Let me do that again for you, boys and girls. On one side, we have Obama, who is a wolf in sheep's clothing. On the other side, forget Fatso. Fatso's not coming out of the next race is out. He ain't even going to fit in the starting gate they have made for him. I mean, they're making this starting gate so narrow, Fatso can't even get in the Republicans. But, okay, so then we have a sheep in sheep's clothing named Romney, who's going to go up against a wolf in sheep's clothing. Who wins that one? I'll be right back.
Savage.
We are talking about so many different topics. I can't even summarize them. So if you've listened to the show, you know where we're at, right? All I can say is politically, we've gone from leathernecks to feathernecks in one generation. And I think you know what I'm talking about, right? Francesca in Florida, welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind is that I just got to get this off my mind. I'm listening at you ever since you started in the 90s, okay? But you do the most marvelous. You're not a host. You're an artist. You're an artist.
That's right.
The way you put it.
You're supposed to be an artist. You're not supposed to be some idiot who sits there and just espouses a Democrat or party line, which is what, unfortunately, a lot is what's done on radio. It's boring.
Yeah. No, you what? Boring? What are you saying?
No, I'm saying if I sat here and just hounded people with Republican viewpoints, nobody would listen to the show.
Well.
So what part of my artistry did you find most engaging in the last segment that made you call?
Everything you said. Everything you said. You know, I used to tape you, and I developed shoeboxes full of tapes, so I don't do it anymore.
Oh, my God. I'll get the FBI after you. You're bootlegging. I'm joking. Come on.
I don't about the wolf, and everything was so great.
Did you like my imitation of the Republicans going, like on every subject?
Yeah.
Right? That was my funniest thing. Francesca, thanks for the comment. No, seriously. I mean, they had such a natural opportunity to leapfrog over the tyrant in the White House, and they've blown it already. Fatso destroyed Romney before he got out of the starting gate. That's number one. So Fatso was put out there by both parties in order to do as much damage as he could to Romney's reputation and to give as much opposition research as possible to Obama prior to the general debates. That was Fatso's job. So you see, he made $1.3 million from Fannie. That's nothing, in my estimation, of what Fatso and his and Calista are going to make when this is all over. And it won't be direct. It's never going to be direct. But Fatso's assured himself an annuity for the rest of his life. Okay? That's all. I could see this from a mile away. Okay. Oh, Iowa. This is a good call. Ben, welcome to the program. Go ahead. Say your piece.
Yeah, I was just wanted to expand on your Obama and wolf's clothing, sheep in wolf's clothing. What about
right.
Mitt Romney being told that he's really a wolf? So he's going to put on sheep's clothing to try and pull the same thing, but it's really a sheep wearing sheep's clothing to make...
That's right. He's a sheep in sheep's clothing. Romney's no wolf. Romney is an intelligent, nice man who started with a great deal of wealth, and he's entitled to that, and built on that wealth from his family, which is good. That's the way it should be. It shouldn't be taken from him. But I don't believe he has the killer instinct, frankly. You know, I remember when I was growing up, again, I don't want to go to growing up. My father used to watch fights every Friday night on the TV, right? And he always used to say to me, take a look at this fight and I'll tell you who's going to win. I said, who? He said, it's well known in the fight industry that only the people with a killer instinct win. I didn't know what that meant. And it was always the hungriest guy who won. Is Romney really hungry for this job?
Not in my opinion, no. I mean, he tries to make it look like, you know, let's go after Obama. But, I mean, the more they carry out this charade of debates and the back and forth.
That's right. That's right. They're cutting their own legs out from under themselves, which is well established now. Everyone has finally seen the wisdom of Michael Savage's observations going back when these debates started. And so, therefore, we have a problem on our hands because we got to get ready for the coming dictatorship. It's as simple as that. Because when you got Obama saying what he just says, play it again. Play clip one again. It's worth playing. We got enough time. Fire it away.
What's frustrated people is that I have not been able to force Congress to
force.
Implement
force.
Every
force.
Aspect of what
force.
I said in 2008. Well, you know, it turns out that our founders designed a system that makes it more difficult to bring about change than I would like sometimes.
See, now he was giving that interview to the subterranean Matt Lauer. As you well know, Matt Lauer is one of the chief subterraneans of the a socialist regime. And the subterranean on NBC just sits there like the dunce he is, doing the subterranean's job, which is being an altar boy for the demise of America and the introduction of vampires on our Constitution. So what can I do about it? Nothing. I'm just a talk show host. I write my books. A lot of people like my books. A lot of people like my show. But at the end of the day, most of them would rather be a young girl, or they'd rather watch an aging Jewish actor from Los Angeles trying to be a tough guy. There's nothing I could do about it. It's the world that I live in. I'm very lucky I have what I have. I thank God that I have the outlet that I have. I thank God that I have the audience that I have. But truthfully, the mass media and the mass marketing of socialism is now at a fever pitch. I do not believe what I'm watching. I'm a social observer, amongst other things. I mean, that could be very entertaining. I have never seen a greater emphasis upon the wonders of socialism in every aspect of our media world than I do under this regime. Never. I've never seen anything like it. And what's astounding to me is that many of the fools who are promoting this would suffer the most under a truly and absolute dictator, a truly socialist regime that they're screaming for. It's astounding. I don't know where they're coming from. I haven't any idea. I mean, analogies come to my mind, but they're a little too extreme for me to express on a radio show because you'll be blown away if I tell you what I see. So I save it for my books. We got a lot to talk about in the next hour on the Savage Nation, whether it be the failed TV series Luck on HBO, Lacage aux Folles at the racetrack, the movie Gray, which I saw. Did you see Gray yet? It's like it grossed almost back its money. It cost $20 million to make. I think it grossed back around $10 million, so someone must have seen it. If you want to talk about the movie Wolf, Gray with the wolves in it, fine. And Liam Neeson, Leathernecks, the Feathernecks, what they're doing to the Navy, Time Show. Clint Eastwood and his faux pas with the Americas at halftime. The guy sitting down on the line there. How wolves break the bones of caribou. Any other topic is fair game right here on the Wolfman of Radio.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Welcome back, or welcome to the Savage Nation. You know the time, I can't tell it to you anyway. It's on so many different stations and so many time zones, there's no point in telling you. All I can say is it's 7 minutes after the hour, right? Depending upon where you are, that's the hour. So it's the day after the Super Bowl, and people are hungover, they're depressed, they got nothing to look forward to. They live through the sports figures, they live through the entertainers, and now there's nothing to look forward to. It's a horrible world, it's blue. They ate too much pizza, they feel sick, they think they're going to get a heart attack, they have a gastric upset, they're positive they got cancer from the pepperoni, they're absolutely sure they gained 3 or 4 pounds from one day of beer and pizza, but they can't stop themselves, and they look in the mirror, they don't know why they're not married to Gisele Bundchen, and they don't understand why they can't throw a ball like that, and they got to get on a subway, they got to ride on the Northern State Parkway, the Southern State Parkway, 280, 380, 480, Highway 1, Highway 5, they have no idea what happened to their lives. So we all do the same thing. We turn to the media for our salvation. Since the church is largely dead for the American people, they don't believe in anything except whatever, the media is now the outlet for most people's hopes, dreams, desires, and hatreds. And so we turn into certain radio shows, TV shows, movies, and whatever, either to love them or hate them or do both at the same time, myself included. I recognize that. We, in essence, are your inspiration and your punching bag. So therefore, I open the lines at 1-800-449-8255 to act either as your, well, inspiration or as your punching bag. I can't review all the topics I touched on because there are too many and they're too numerous. We're talking about everything from why the Republicans are likely to lose in the general election because they're running a sheep in sheep's clothing in Romney against a wolf in sheep's clothing in Obama. And Fatso has so undermined Romney that there's almost no way for Romney to ever recover his equilibrium after what Fatso and the neuron-deficient Ron Paul and Mr. Vest did to him. So here we are. We're sitting here. We're watching TV. I notice that after this, all the big pizza companies are running specials. It's amazing. I try to avoid pizza, but it's my favorite food. It's one of the foods I can't resist. There's two foods I can resist, French fries and pizza. But, I mean, they're horrible for me, right? $10 for a limited time only? Now, this company's $11 for a pizza? Even a guy like me who's allergic to dairy and cheese, I'm tempted to have a pizza tonight. I mean, I'll wash it down with beer and have. Why am I doing it? You know what? I won't feel as bad as I did from the healthful Japanese food last night. I'll tell you right now. All right, so my joints won't work. I'll hobble around the house in the morning. I won't be able to move from the pizza and beer fest. But it would be well worth it compared to what I felt last night from the healthful Japanese meal I had. I varied. I went off the menu into the buckwheat noodles because I know that they're anti-cancer, you know, on a minor level. I'm going to tell you, it's an interesting story. The hydrocyanic acid-rich foods, which we've eliminated from our diets, is a fascinating story. You know, you look at apple seeds, they have HCN in them, hydrocyanic acid, which inhibit the growth of cancer cells. Theoretically, of course, you can't prove it, but it's a very interesting theory that has great science, good science attached to it. And it is somewhat connected to the debunked lateral theory of anti-cancer work, which is along the same lines. But you take a look at the foods that your grandmother used to eat. She lived to 39, probably. But let's say a healthful ancestor who lived a long time. The mythical ancestor who lived a long time. All of my ancestors died young, so it doesn't matter. In my case, everything is an anomaly. I remember when I don't want to go down that road. I've done it. It's not even funny. They're all dead. Let them rest in peace. Everyone dead before 50. So to me, each day is a miracle. And so today I go to the nursery because it's already early spring, as you well know, everywhere but in Al Gore's mind. Alaska has the worst, like one of the most ferocious winters on record. And you'll notice that the media doesn't show you this snow in Rome as well. You notice? Because there's a big myth. Global warming, because it's warm in America, they want you to think it's universally warm and the world is rotting, the glaciers, I mean, the bears are screaming for your help. But there's snow in Rome. They're freezing to death in Brussels. Alaska is buried under tons of snow. The ice packs are reforming. Okay, so the jet stream's running a little higher. That's the whole point than it normally does. It's the only reason we don't have that much precipitation and why we have a rather mild winter. So here in Northern California, it seems like the winter is over, largely. And I'm a man of the earth. I'm a natural man, which is why you love the show. I sound like a natural person. I am a natural person with all of the flaws attached to nature. Don't consider me, a rose. I mean, the barbs and all of that. You look at a rose. Why does a rose have thorns on to keep you from picking the rose? Why does a strawberry have barbs on it? If you look at a strawberry under a microscope or a magnifying glass, even a strawberry has barbs on it. Why? Why are there barbs on the berries? Barbs on your berries? The same reason we as Americans should still have barbs on our berries, but no longer do. We have been debarbed on our berries, which is why our berries are being eaten by our enemies. That's a good analogy. So being a natural man, I know that it's very late winter. Winter's over here. It's a mild winter to begin with. So I go to the nursery today because my orchard was denuded a little bit this year. I have a small orchard on a certain property. And I love peaches. I love apricots. And my peach trees were allowed to die by a gardener who ignored them. And I can't pay attention to every tree and every, you know, figment of grass that I own. So instead of complaining about it, I go to a nursery. You know, it's one of the most, I don't know, renewing things you could do. I hate to sound so PC, but it's very renewing to go to a nursery in late winter, early spring. And they have like the apricot trees are in, the peach trees are in from Oregon. And there's, of course, no fruit on them. There's no leaves on them, but they're beautiful. They're so filled with promise. And you realize that tree in 30, 40 years, you know how big that thing is going to be? It's beautiful. So I bought three trees today. I bought two peach trees and a pear tree. And you say, well, why would you do that? Why? Why do you do anything? You got to believe in something. And so I believe in survival. And I believe that survival is as good an organizing principle as anything on the planet. Which brings me back again to the political world, which is why I am not a Democrat, why I hate socialists, and why I hate liberals. Because they are the wolves in sheep's clothing. They want to steal our freedoms. They want to take us away from our founding documents. They want to take us away from our free republic and turn us into a chained republic. That's why. I don't want to be ruled by a bunch of wolves in sheep clothing. I'm sorry. I don't go for their line that they're for the poor and the downtrodden and the weak. They're the most aggressive, vicious people I've ever encountered in my life. They've done more harm to me personally in my life than any other social or political group. The hardcore liberal, they're dangerous. They're vermin. They're the most... Okay, I've said all I want to say. Anymore, I'm going to start to sound illiterate. And as you well know, I'm probably the most literate man in the history of the American media. That's the major media. Of course, there are people more literate than I, but no one ever heard of them. Most of them are in England and no one reads them. They usually commit suicide from too much alcohol and cigarettes. But some of them are quite brilliant. I mean, they are. You know. But don't be fooled by accents. I want to tell you something about accents for a minute. When I was young, because I was an immigrant's son, I thought that anyone with an English accent was high class and brilliant. But it takes more than an accent to be high class and brilliant, by the way. I met some of the lowest people on earth with great accents and terrific clothing. I'm not going to say likewise, the reverse is true, because it is true. I've also met people in overalls or noblemen, and we all know that's true. So don't underestimate a man just because he speaks differently than you, and don't overestimate a man because he's particularly eloquent. Okay? Just watch out for the wolves. That's all I can tell you. And, you know, after watching that movie, Gray, and I see the wolf packs hunting humans, circling them and ripping them to shreds, even if it was fictionalized, I start to see the world in a different way now. It's like now even when I'm driving, it's almost like a paranoid reaction. Now every other car is like a wolf. I don't mean I see a wolf's face. I'm not saying that. But in other words, you know how you're driving a highway and you're like making sure that the Priuses will pretend that they're sheep but they're really wolves? See, like Prius drivers are all wolves driving sheep cars. But they're the most aggressive SOBs in the history of the American Autobahn. They cut you off from the right lane. They give you a finger. They all have an Obama bumper sticker or some other lecture point on the rear of their car. Horrible human beings, all wrapped up in an automobile. So as I say to you, everything starts to look a little different to me now. My father was 100% right. Don't trust anybody. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Go in politics and the media. You know, remember Anthony Weiner, the sex scandal with the texting of himself? Remember that story, how hot that was? I mean, I fully expect by segment 5 of the HBO series with Dustin Hoffbrown that Anthony Weiner will do a cameo with Dustin Hoffbrown and Dennis Farina on Luck playing another gangster. And there's no question in my mind that Anthony Weiner wants to come make a TV career out of playing a gangster like Dustin Hoffbrown. I mean, I'm positive. I mean, there's nowhere else for him to go. If he's a failed politician from Brooklyn, what else could he do but play a gangster? I have no idea why, but that seems to be their role model, most of these actors. Wow, what callers I got on everything. Romney not a lamb. Tina, in Florida, go ahead. You're on the Savage Net. How do you know Romney's not a lamb?
Dr. Savage, I think you're underestimating Mitt Romney's character. He is a very nice man. But he is no lamb. He got elected in the bluest state, the most corrupt state of Massachusetts.
No, I understand. I didn't say he's a lamb. I said he's a sheep.
I said
he's a sheep in sheep's clothing. Okay, but let's not split hairs. Don't you think he's too mild to compete with the wolf in sheep's clothing?
No, I don't think you've seen his side. You're underestimating that he was in business for many years.
But listen, I'd like him to win, but here's the problem. I heard 3 weeks ago the death knell of the Romney campaign. When he had the opportunity to sink his teeth into Obama's horrendous track record as a president, you know what he said? He said, Obama's not a bad man, he's just over his head. I heard those same words from McCain, and that's when McCain lost the election. See, this is what I'm saying to you. The very same so-called campaign advisors who destroyed McCain, who took McCain's equivocations or weaknesses and made them even more pronounced, are going to do the same thing to Romney, which is why Romney can't win. Romney won't come on the Savage Nation. Romney won't come on other conservative talk shows. And Romney wants you to vote for him. He'll get the Republican vote for sure. But he needs that magical 15% of swing voters. He's not going to get them. They're not going to go to Obama necessarily. They're just going to stay home. Unless he gives the conservative or Tea Party base, if you will, wish to put it that way, because to me, Tea Party is welcome here. Tea Party is not yet a dirty word. I notice everybody else in the media suddenly taking the lead of the Congressional Black Caucus and the corrupt Democrat-controlled unions and have started to slam the Tea Parties as though they're the Nazi Party revisited, which is furthest thing from the truth. To me, ACORN is the Nazi Party revisited, and the unions are acting more like the brown shirts than any other group in the United States of America. But the fact of the matter is, Tea Party people, they're still out there, whether they're as organized as another story. They're not going to come out in force to vote for a meek sheep in sheep's clothing like Romney, unless Romney goes in for the, I'm sorry to say, the kill, and really takes Obama on where he's vulnerable, on his tyrannical moves, on the NDAA, which he happens to agree with, which is shocking, and that's another giveaway. At a certain point, I'm afraid to tell you there's not that much difference on some fundamentals between the two, and that's why people will say, well, you know what, I'll stay with this guy. I don't want to try anyone new. So, I mean, I can only do what I can do. And I can joke about things only so much, and then it becomes very, very agitating to see what this man, Obama, wants to do to our Constitution, which is shred it. I played the soundbite 4 times in the first hour. I'll play it again right now till you finally hear it. Listen to it again. Wait, as he talks to the subterranean Matt Lauer on NBC.
What's frustrated people is that I have not been able to force Congress to implement every aspect of what I said in 2008. Well, you know, it turns out that our founders designed a system that makes it more difficult to bring about change than I would like sometimes.
So he talks to the subterranean, Matt Lauer, that he can't force Congress to do what he wants. And Matt Lauer, the subterranean, instead of saying, wait a minute, Mr. President, that's what a separation of powers was created for, was to prevent men from becoming dictators. Instead, the useless subterranean, useless to the American freedom lovers, but very useful to the dictators, sits there like the dummy he is, and he lets him get away with that, which is why NBC uses subterraneans at every turn. So it's very worrisome indeed when there is no vocalism against what Obama has done, and it's really frightening to see the tyrannical maneuvers that he and his advisors have conducted and gotten away with. I'll give you another big one. The greatest foreign policy disaster in American history in my lifetime that I can see, one of the greatest foreign policy disasters has emerged under Obama, and that is meddling in the Arab world. The exact opposite of what these politicians are telling you has occurred is occurring. They call it the Arab Spring when it's the Arab Winter, a term I phrased, which was picked up by everybody in the media without attribution, which is the way it is when you're Lao Tzu. But the fact of the matter is, here we are. Here we are. We have an Arab winter where fascists are emerging in every nation that was destabilized by George Soros's money, by Jimmy Carter and Ms. Brzezinski's architecture, by Hillary Clinton's public relations. You have the Arab crescent on fire, and Obama sits there on his throne acting as though everything is fine and everything he's touched has come up like roses. Instead of saying a word about it, Mitt Romney has been rather silent on this. Instead, he's let Fatso rip him to shreds. I mean, Romney could have said 100 times to Fatso, look, you know what you're doing? You're undermining the Republican Party. You're undermining the Republic itself. Why don't you just get off the stage because you are a useless idiot, and what you're doing, Mr. Gingrich, is destroying any chance to bring down this dictatorship. Now, everybody would have loved him for that. But again, he played Mr. Nice Guy because he is a nice guy. He is too nice for the job. So in other words, Romney is not the wolfhound that you think he is. You see what I'm saying? And he's being attacked at every turn by a pack of wolves on both sides of the aisle. He's being attacked by a pack of wolves. He's not the wolfhound, nor is he surrounded by the wolfhounds that we wish for.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. I guess the most significant thoughts to come out of this show are exposing the differences between the candidates, Romney versus Obama, with Obama being a wolf in sheep's clothing. Now he attacks the Constitution and the Founding Fathers, and he gets away with it because he goes before the subterranean Matt Lauer on NBC. He says, "Oh, the Constitution is a little cumbersome. I can't force Congress to do what I want." And the subterranean Matt Lauer sits there like the useful stooge that he is supposed to be, that he's paid for to be, without saying, "But Mr. President, that's exactly what was supposed to happen to prevent people like you from taking over everyone's life from cradle to grave." Instead, the subterranean who works for General Electric sits there and blinks, says nothing. I don't even think he understands this schmuck. Personally, I don't think Matt Lauer even understands what freedom is. A man like him is not a free man. This man is a creature of the prison of NBC, the prison of major media. Let's put it to you that way. So now we come to Romney. Romney, as I say, is, I think, too meek for this job, too nice. And I mean that in a positive way. Unfortunately, it's true. You've got to remember that the man is a devout Mormon. And in that sense, he's a kind, wonderful human being. You've got to remember he was also a missionary for a couple of years because Mormons are missionaries. They have to be in order to remain members of the church. I remember the years I worked in the Fiji Islands, Tonga, I met several Mormon missionaries. They're wonderful people. In fact, that's how many of the islanders became Mormons and remain Mormons is because of the missionaries. Good for them, too, or else they'd have a much worse life than they currently have in their island paradises, stated sarcastically. So, therefore, as a former missionary, he's a very good man. Now, you compare a communist street agitator to a former missionary. Let me ask you, who's more vicious? Who's more likely to go for the jugular during a debate? That's what I'm talking about. Who is hungrier to win? Who is hungrier to win for winning's sake? The communist street organizer or the missionary? Who's going to win that? Who's going to win that battle? Okay, so let's go to the callers. Miguel in Texas, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Yes, Romney is certainly a good guy, and he was a missionary. But the reality is that he also was a business capitalist. He could not actually be successful in their ventures, and making $250 million just would be a nice guy. He made decisions. He actually fired people, and he got rid of the garbage that was encumbering all those companies. Some of them made successful, the ones that he couldn't dispose of them. There's no Mr. Nice Guys there. He actually had to make...
Well, yes, I agree with you, but there are different levels of predator. In other words, the wolf is, let's say, the alpha predator in some sense. But we don't know what level of predator Romney might actually be in his heart of hearts. I mean, how strong-hearted is he for this battle is what I'm asking you.
Well, it might be that, you know, remember, when he was bring up in the Mormon religion, he's always putting a face of my guy. But remember also, he had all these strength. I mean, when he was a youngster, I read that he went and opposed the guys that were opposing during his Stanford days, you know, the war in Vietnam. So he was actually, he has shown, you know, those flashes of strength.
Yeah, well, let's look at the coming debate between Obama and Romney. Who's going to get more vicious?
Definitely Obama is going to get vicious, but if there is a reaction similar to what happened to Romney after being a nice guy in South Carolina and he came back roaring back, if he does that, then I take my lumps with Romney. I think that he will be able to put up.
Well, I hope you're right. Maybe Gingrich was a trial by fire for him. And in that sense, maybe there's a value to Fatso having been so malicious. Maybe you toughen Romney up to the game he's in. I don't know. Thank you for the call. I really don't know. And let's hope for the best. But this Obama and his attack on the Constitution is perhaps the most worrying thing and the most telling thing about this tyrannical administration I have yet seen. I mean, everything this man does indicates he would like to have a constitutional convention and do away with anything that is an impediment to absolute power. Florida John, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Good evening, Dr. Savage. How are you, sir? Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment in regards to the comment that Obama, when he can get up there and say, you know, word for word what he said, that the Constitution makes it you know, tougher for him to make changes than he would like. You know, that's kind of scary. I mean, there's obviously an underlying, you know, tone there.
But did you hear what he said to the subterranean Matt Lauer? He said he's not always been able to force Congress to do the things he wanted. Emphasis on the word force. Force is directly related to the word fascist. You understand that, of course.
Yes, sir. I'm a fairly new listener, not to cut you off, Dr. Savage. I'm a fairly new listener. I've been listening probably since about 06. If there was nobody else, you know, speaking the words you speak and studying the way you study, I don't know where I would be personally in regards to my young family and what I'm trying to teach them. You know, I just look forward to you being on the air for another 30 or 40 years, I can tell you that.
Well, that's not going to happen, John. First of all, I don't want to say that. It won't happen. It won't be 30 years. But let's let it hang in the air. You know, every day is another day in heaven. And another day in paradise. And I do appreciate what your call was about. I get the meaning of it. So I don't want to beat up this whole thing on the Constitution because it's a good way to drive an audience away. Most people could care less about the U.S. Constitution. They care more about the aging Susie who should be home baking, making lasagna instead of throwing herself around like she's a naked hot chick than they do about the U.S. Constitution. That's all I can tell you. Now, one thing has nothing to do with the other, but that's the way it is. I'm still amazed by the Super Bowl halftime ad by Clint Eastwood, which is a big buzz thing, you know. Now he came out today and he said there was no politics involved. He's not an Obama supporter. It seems that he's backtracking. What do I know? I'm a fan of Clint Eastwood. Everyone can do what they want. It's a free country. To me, it looked like he was calling for auto bailouts. That's my interpretation. Does that make him a bad guy? It doesn't make him a bad guy. Maybe he thought the auto bailout was a good thing. The fact of the matter is the U.S. taxpayer took it in the shorts for $1.4 billion on the bailout of Chrysler, and Fiat was the big winner. In plain English, the Obama regime gave $1.4 billion to Fiat, an Italian auto company, in their bailout of Chrysler. You do the math, and you figure out the money trail, and then you think if you could ever figure out where some of that money has ever come back to him. How would I know? Well, we got some amazing calls on this wolf thing, but this is more fun than one I'm going to take now. Jonathan in New York on WOR. Go ahead, please.
Shalom, shalom, great Dr. Savage. I want to thank you with all of my heart, soul, mind, and strength.
Please, let's not go through the as-salams. I appreciate them. What's on your mind?
I just want to thank you so much. You saved a relationship with my girlfriend. That means all the beautiful stars out there from Yahweh created. But you saved a beautiful relationship.
Sir, let's start again. Are you a liberal or a conservative, and is she a liberal or a conservative?
We're both independent thinkers now. I was an independent thinker for a long time, you know, being raised with a great Irish family. But she was a hardcore liberal, and I just had to keep playing you over the years. I remember when you were on TV in 94.
Yes, I had a sterling three-month career.
I remember seeing you.
But because I was not a sufficient subterranean, I didn't last any longer on the General Electric subsidiary. Apparently, they wanted someone a little more subservient, a little more subversive.
Well, I love you, Mike.
Which is about all they have. Is about all they have now are subversives and subterraneans. I mean, that's why they pay those marionettes to hate America and the Constitution and call for a dictatorship in more words than one. So how did I save the relationship? Make it simple for the average listener.
Well, we started. I was doing gardening work for a long time in my life, you know, digging into the earth. And
all right, I appreciate it. It's too already too personal. I'm exhausted. It's like eating scallions right now. I don't want to eat scallions. It's like a mental scallion I was about to eat. I think I want to have a pizza cooler. I want a caller right now that is as satisfying as a sausage pizza and a beer. That's what I like. Why are all of the, you know, like yesterday was the second biggest pizza sale day in America, the Super Bowl day, which is understandable. But so they carry it over. They want the sales boost the second. They keep it at $10. There's a crook pizza guy in the area where I live. You know how much I paid for a pizza? $26 a month ago. I'll never go back to that crook again. And it had almost no it had no sauce on it. That's the latest trick, by the way. You notice how they cheat you on sauce because tomatoes are expensive? They are cheating you on sauce. That's the latest trick of the corporate pizza, is to give you almost no sauce. So you have to ask for extra sauce to make it taste like an actual piece of pizza. Everything is extra. Give me a pizza with extra cheese, extra sauce, and extra crust. Because basically what you're selling me is like matzo with ketchup on it. That's basically what you're getting. It's like leftover matzo with a little, you know, dried out ketchup sauce on it. Ohio, Dave, welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Michael, I wanted to know, since you paint the best pictures of San Francisco, especially in Abuse of Power, I've
right.
been only once to the city, okay?
Right,
and
right.
And it was late September, beautiful. But
right.
I want to come back. I want to know okay. when is the best weather-wise time to experience the things that you have painted out in, you know, on the radio and in the book?
That's a beautiful, beautiful question, because my street descriptions in Abuse of Power, I think, equal or exceed anyone who's ever written about San Francisco. There's no question. I know what you're referring to. I'll bet you $1 million. Well, maybe I'll bet you a dollar that one of the scenes you're referring to in the book Abuse of Power is when Jack and Tony are walking up over the crest of a hill down, and they see the bay down below, and it's China Blue. I'll bet you that scene sticks in your mind, right?
Right, right, in North Beach.
Right, exactly. And the lighting in North Beach, the Italianate buildings and the way the light hits the buildings at a certain time. Look, this is winter now still, early spring. It's beautiful time of year. The light is especially gorgeous right now. Summer can be very foggy. It's not the best time to visit San Francisco. Frankly, when the rains are over, it's going to rain here tomorrow, but then we get sun usually after rain for a few days. Gorgeous. The lighting is still superb. But you want to see the bay in the winter? That's when it's China Blue. The China Blue color of San Francisco Bay that I describe in Abuse of Power is seen only in wintertime, incidentally. What other descriptive scenes stick in your mind? I'm very curious. This is a very interesting call for me.
That one, I mean, just your depictions of the water. I mean, to think of,
yeah.
of surf crashing. But here is what maybe you can put in your next book, a description. My first time arriving in the city from the BART, from the airport to the BART station underground, I got out in Mission Street. And it was 11:30 at night, and there was this eerie, bizarre, I'd never seen anything like this fog in my life. It was like another planet, Michael.
Yes. Well,
beautiful.
do you like fog? Do you want to see fog?
I've never seen that kind of fog.
Well, if you liked the experience, the mystic feeling of fog, come in August when it's the foggiest in San Francisco. Your call's breaking up. You know, every time I drive over the Golden Gate Bridge at night after a radio show and you see those red, the reddish-orange towers, the way they're painted, I look up at the towers and they played such a prominent part in my novel Abuse of Power. It astonishes me that the level of illiteracy in the San Francisco Bay Area, the level of bigotry and illiteracy is at an epidemic level in the Bay Area. Unless a novel proffers the subterranean subversive view of the world, unless it proposes an anti-American, anti-family, anti-church, anti-police, anti-military view, the novel does not exist. That is how paltry the so-called literary community has become in the San Francisco Bay Area. It does not exist. It exists only in their own minds. They're living in another world, and the world, unfortunately, is very, very limited for the sake of literature, which is why I think I've achieved some new highs. I'm sure that Abuse of Power and Time will be seen for what it is. It's actually a masterpiece. I'm working on the next one right now in the midst of this other nonfiction coming out. I'm actually in the midst of the next Jack Hatfield adventure, if you can believe it. He's a lovely character. Everyone loves the name Jack Hatfield. Based upon a true character, a few true characters that I know melded into one. But I have some changes coming up in the next one. I don't want to get ahead of myself. It's a year from now. Big changes. I could ask you some questions about it. I don't even know if... Did you like the fact, if you read Abuse of Power, that one of the heroes was a Muslim woman? Did you like that or did you not like that? It's an interesting question. Because I don't know who's made a Muslim woman a hero. Here I make a Muslim woman a hero because, as you know, most Muslim women oppose the mullahs. They want them out of their lives. They don't like them telling them they can't drive a car, etc. And yet you would think, as a result of that, there'd be a huge audience amongst modern Muslim men and women. But there hasn't been. So I didn't write that in order to get Muslims to buy the book, but I'm shocked at how limited the level of literacy is in America. But then watching that skank from New Jersey cavorting on the stage yesterday at halftime tells me everything I've ever known. And you couple that with this guy, Dustin Half-Brown, on luck. And you realize that the American mind is quite rigid, incapable of even distinguishing between one form of art and another. I mean, Dustin Half-Brown, who is on Half-Brown, what's his name, Hoffman? Okay, Half-Brown. Dustin Half-Brown, who is on the series Luck, playing a Jewish, an aging Jewish gangster, Abe, is laughable. Again, with a guy next to him, Dennis Frena, who, I swear to God, it looks like Lacage Fall at a racetrack. That's all I can say to you. They look like two old gay guys living together in an apartment in Chicago near a racetrack. I don't quite understand how we are supposed to take them seriously. Sometimes during their dialogues, I turn the sound off and I feel like I'm watching Lacage Fall again. And yet we're supposed to take this seriously. Now, how is an American absorber of popular culture supposed to know art from schmaltz, good from bad, when a guy like Hoffman thinks he can get away with being an actor, and an old, you know, skanky singer who was good 20 years ago has the nerve, the nerve to sell herself to NBC and get on and do a halftime number that was laughable? How can they know what art is? I say to myself as I don't eat a pizza. I'll be right back.
Savage.
So Obama and Axelrod are acting like the cats that ate the cream because of the damage that the fatso has done to Romney and the others. And, of course, then you got the fake job figures. Everyone knows he didn't create 3 million jobs. That's nonsense. And nobody on the Republican side has attacked him on his failures, which is what they should have been doing through the entire campaign. If the RNC had any brains, which I doubt that they do, they're just a powerful organization with unlimited funding by old money, primarily. And the RNC is funded by old money and giant corporations, and there's nothing wrong with old money nor giant corporations, but they tend to be rather prehistoric in their political activities rather than able to flex along the lines of the very, very skillful Obama machine, which is able to get away with virtually anything. So therefore, one of the greatest disasters that Obama has indulged in is the Arab disaster, across the Arab Crescent, stabbing Israel in the back while basically supporting the enemies of Israel, letting the Syrian dictator kill thousands of people and doing nothing, one policy error after another, losing the most advanced drone in history, 23 Navy SEALs killed in one swoop on a helicopter, a story that is yet to be told, an investigation that is yet to be done by the military. More Navy SEALs lost in one accident, so to speak, than all SEALs lost in all campaigns in the history of the SEAL unit, all under the commander-in-chief. Who put those Navy SEALs on one old, slow-flying Chinook helicopter? Why has there been no outcry in Congress? Why has there been no investigation of the commander-in-chief's decision, if it was his, in fact? And if it wasn't the commander-in-chief's decision to kill all of those SEALs by accidentally putting them on one slow-flying helicopter, flying them into a danger zone, who did that? Who in the military told him to do that? Who? Sounds very much like another scandalous situation along the lines of Fast and Furious Guns to Mexico, where Lanny Breuer, a lifetime left-wing fanatic Democrat lawyer, was the one behind smuggling the guns to Mexico, which resulted in the death of Brian Terry and many, many deaths in Mexico. Was it another fanatic, subterranean communist lawyer inside the Defense Department who said, put them all into that helicopter? Who did this? Which girl was it from Harvard, or was it a girl from Cornell who told the military to put them all in one helicopter? Who did it?
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
mustache is dope. And my grandson's doing what he's doing. He's swinging from the chandelier with six broads. And then someone upstairs, a neighbor, whatever, drops a dime, and they bring the canines. They find the stash, 6 kilos of cocaine. You couldn't send them out to buy 6 pounds of dog food the shape he was in 4 years ago.
Well, the feds had to know.
Of course they knew. They want me to roll over on Mike and his offshore. I roll over on Mike or the kid takes the fall.
Well, the question is this. After you take door number 3, where you claim the dope and you do the time, the question is, Ace, what if it was all turned around?
And the answer is, Mike would have given me up in a heartbeat. So what? I never ratted on anybody in my life. And I wouldn't do it even with that.
I don't know why you wouldn't let me kill that.
Stop it. Stop it.
Hypothetic, I'm saying. Hypothetic.
It's enough. And it's hypothetic.
What's frustrated people is that I have not been able to force Congress to implement every aspect of what I said in 2008. Well, you know, it turns out that our founders designed a system that makes it more difficult to bring about change than I would like sometimes. What we have been able to do is move in the right direction. And what I'm just going to keep on doing is plodding away, very persistent. And you know what? One of the things about being president is you get better as time goes on.
Here are the stories that made it to michaelsavage.com. Iran's supreme leader, another very famous religious Muslim, says kill all the Jews and annihilate Israel. And he says it's called for in his religious book, the Quran. Do you know of any other Bible or religious tract that calls for killing? Genocide. No, of course you don't. All religions are equal, as you well know. Just ask Obama. Libyan militia accused of torturing to death an ambassador. Why not? Obama's made up jobless numbers. Shoe bomber to be released on opening day of Olympics. Why are they releasing him? I guess they need a plane to go down. U.S. closes embassy in Syria. It's the most drastic U.S. move so far after 11 months of a violent crackdown. Obama thinks he deserves a second term even if the economy slumps. Why? He's entitled to it.
Do you deserve a second term?
I deserve a second term, but we're not done. Look, when you and I sat down, we were losing 750,000 jobs a month. In fact, we had found out just a few days before we sat down that we had lost that month 750,000 jobs. Now we're creating 250,000. We've created 3.7 million jobs over the last 23 months. We've created the most jobs since 2005, the most manufacturing jobs since 1990. But we're not finished.
Obama's Arab Springsters to prosecute 44 foreign workers, including the son of the federal government's transportation secretary. Can you believe that? He's stuck in Egypt and he can't get him out of there. 8 sailors thrown out of the Navy for being too manly. They were having a wrestling match, and apparently the new Navy has no room for wrestling. It's called hazing. Get the picture? Labor unions plan to occupy CPAC. Obama's Arab winter results in hundreds more slaughtered in Syria. North Korea using U.S. drones purchased from the Middle East. Romney cruising to victory one state after the other, but the rolling fat old white wall tire Gingrich won't give up.
I am a candidate for President of the United States. I will be a candidate for President of the United States. We will go to Tampa. So I'm not comfortable, as Governor Romney said he was, with simply allowing people to languish in the safety net. Tonight, he will do reasonably well. This is one of his best states. It is a very heavily Mormon state. The last time around, Ron Paul was in second place. Anytime we're in a caucus state, Dr. Paul has a substantial advantage. I think I will do better than John McCain did 3 years ago. We will get some delegates here. Obviously, we'd like to get more, but we're very happy to be competing here. Every primary day or caucus day, the Romney headquarters in Boston sends out the rumor that they believe I will withdraw, which is, of course, their greatest fantasy. I'm not going to withdraw. I'm actually pretty happy with where we are. And I think the contrast between Governor Romney and me is going to get wider and wider and clearer over the next few weeks.
Controversial artist depicts Obama trampling the Constitution. Take a look at the picture. It's frightening. It's something positive. A dog, a beautiful, huge mastiff, Didn't mind adding one more to her litter of pups, only this one was a chimpanzee. One picture is worth a thousand words. Actor Ben Gazzara, one of my favorites, died last week at age 81. New York native of Sicilian heritage, one of the best actors of his time. Bears kept in tiny cages by Chinese for their bile are committing suicide with hunger strikes. Here's a good story. A would-be thief was killed in a mugging attempt. He tried to mug two white guys. Well, he tried to mug two guys. One of them was a wrestling expert. Put him in a headlock, and by the time the police arrived, this big, burly, would-be mugger was dead. How do you like that? 1-800-449-8255. This is the Savage Nation.
What's frustrated people is that I have not been able to force Congress to implement every aspect of what I said in 2008. Well, you know, it turns out that our founders designed a system that makes it more difficult to bring about change than I would like sometimes.
Wow, you know how much that irritates me. Well, imagine how your throat will get this winter without Pine Brothers Softish Throat Drops. That's right. I'm talking about Pine Brothers Softish Throat Drops we all grew up with. They're back in natural honey and wild cherry flavors. Pine Brothers has been a trusted brand since 1870. Visit them on the web at pinebrothers.com. That's pinebrothersyum.com.
Savage.
Among faith, obviously, Governor Mormon is a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He's a Mormon. He won big among Mormons. He won 9 out of every 10 votes among Mormons. Congressman Paul coming in second place. But he also won. Those who say they have no religion voted for Congressman Paul, but other Christians, Mormons, Catholics, mainline Protestants, all going for Governor Romney.
I'm going to lighten things up a little bit because it gets too hot. We got to slow her down. We'll come back to very strong politics in a minute. Tel Aviv, Israel, way into the book, in the middle of it. Welcome to the city that never sleeps, the Reb said as they exited the highway. Traffic was light on the new express lane into Tel Aviv, and the drive-in from Ben-Gurion International Airport had taken them only 20 minutes. Rabbi Mel Nirsham had come in from San Francisco on an earlier flight to make the appropriate arrangements for Jack's arrival. Jack had known Nirsham for many years now. They'd met through a mutual acquaintance, Bill Hicks, a private detective. Hicks and Hatfield frequented the same restaurant, a place on Columbus, the North Beach restaurant, where they both liked to eat at the bar as they watched the crowd coming and going while they talked what they called the unholy trinity, sports and politics and religion. The city's ruling elite still ate there. Pelosi, Brown, the former mayor, all the known and hidden power brokers. One night, Hatfield brought up his disenchantment with the Catholic Church, echoing his father's own discontent, and complained that it had lost its edge and become too pacifist. No fire, no brimstone. If you're looking for fire and brimstone, Hicks said, you should check out my old friend, Rabbi Nirsham, toughest Jew I know. The more he heard about this rebellious Rebbe, hence the Reb, the more curious Jack got. Although he'd been raised Catholic, he'd always been attracted to his mother's history and culture. So a few days later, he set up a meet with Nirsham, discovered a kindred soul, and the two became instant friends. And when the Reb found out Hatfield had Jewish blood, he insisted Jack join him and his friends on Friday nights for prayer, vodka, and a home-cooked meal, an invitation Jack had accepted more than once. This is from Abuse of Power, page 169. Hicks had been right. Nirsham was a tough old Jew. The product of an Orthodox day school, the Reb had fallen out of love with Judaism in his late teens, and much to his parents' dismay, decided to rebel. He was a hippie in the 60s, later a boxer. Then in his middle years, he rediscovered his roots with a fierce passion and spent 5 years studying Jewish law at a rabbinical seminary in New York. This was followed by a year in Israel before returning to San Francisco as an ordained rabbi. The Reb was a black hat, a Chabad Lubavitch Hasid, who often spent weeks at a time in Tel Aviv. Jack himself hadn't been here in years. The first thing he noticed now was how much the place had grown. Comparisons to New York were no longer as laughable as they'd once been. Tel Aviv was a thriving metropolis perched on the edge of the Mediterranean. Everything about it screamed big city. So where are we headed, he asked the rabbi as they took the exit. First, we do something about those clothes. Jack was wearing jeans and a suede leather jacket. You want to blend in with us. You'll have to look the part. Hatfield had once asked him why Hasidic Jews always wore dark clothing, and Nirsham explained they were more concerned with what was on the inside rather than what was fashionable. In fact, These Hasids wore 19th century Polish business garb. They were stuck in a fashion time warp. I'm not so sure about blending in, Jack said. If I dressed like you, I'd probably look more like Johnny Cash than Menachem Schneerson. The rabbi smiled. Bring a guitar, you'll get all the girls. Anyway, I won't read you anymore because it starts to give away too much of the plot. It's, some of the lines are very funny, by the way. Let's see. All right, I'll read you a little bit more because it's fun. Page 171. I'm trying to skip plot elements so that you go out and you read the book yourself. Let's see. It hadn't taken much convincing to get the rabbi involved in Jack's plight. The Reb was rumored to have connections to both Mossad and the Israeli mafia. And while he wasn't a violent man, he'd never shied from a good fight. He was also known to quote Rabbi Meir Kahane, the founder of the Radical Jewish Defense League, who was assassinated in a Manhattan hotel room in 1990 by persons unknown. Every Jew, a 22, the Reb had said more than once. A staunch proponent of the Second Amendment, the Reb had always supported a well-armed citizenry, which he believed was the only way to keep another Castro or Stalin or Hitler or Chavez from rising in America. The one thing that stops an evil government from seizing total power, he once told Jack, is fear of millions of armed citizens. The Brits learned that lesson a couple of hundred years ago. Yet despite his tough talk, the Reb was genuinely a kind and friendly man. He acted as a missionary to fallen Jews he met in the streets of San Francisco, trying to bring them back to God. He'd saved many a drugged-out soul over the years, and they loved him for throwing them a spiritual life preserver when they were drowning. In some ways, Jack was in need of a life preserver himself, and once he told his story, the Reb was all too happy to help. Michael Savage, Abuse of Power, the finest novel written about San Francisco since Jack London, in my opinion. And it's in my humble opinion. I wouldn't say it if I actually didn't believe it. I mean, you think it's tongue-in-cheek, you're mistaken. My descriptions of San Francisco and of the Bay and of boating have never been surpassed by anybody that I know of, or I wouldn't have written the book. Okay, let me read your page. Page 242 of Abuse of Power. London, England. It was a cardinal rule of intelligence work that Sarah had learned. If your cover has been compromised, either go deep undercover or hide in plain sight. Going to ground was not an option. Fortunately, Sarah and Jack looked a mess and stank of perspiration from the torture. Their flight, days without a shower. Any description MI6 might have sent out barely applied to the dirty, disheveled couple who showed up for the train ride back to London. They had taken the precaution of having a drink, so their breath suggested a night of heavy partying. And they acted the part as they purchased tickets with the cash Jack had been carrying. They reached London without a hitch and cabbed to the school. The young man's name was Faisal Al-Jubeer. He couldn't have been more than 26 years old and was an inch taller than Jack, with dark skin and a thick black beard. He seemed a bit irritated as he opened the door at nearly 1 in the morning. The moment he saw Sarah, his annoyance evaporated. He didn't even seem to see Jack, not at first. "Ms. Gada," he said in surprise. "Sarah, what are you doing here?" "I'm sorry if we woke you, Faisal." "Actually, no, I was studying for..." He paused, frowning at her. Like everyone else, he saw and was mesmerized by Sarah's face. "It's a long story," she told him. "Are you all right?" "I'm fine, but I desperately need your help." He looked confused. "My help? May we come in?" He hesitated, glancing at Jack as though seeing him for the first time. Then he stepped back and opened the door wide. "Of course," he said. "Come in." "Thank you, Faisal." They stepped into a clean but modest flat full of furniture that looked as if it had come with the rental. Cheap and functional. There was a small kitchenette with a dining table in front of it, the table cluttered with books and spiral binders, illuminated by a reading lamp. It was like being in a neat version of Max's hacker friend Dave Karras's place, with one exception. Among the books was Fundamentals of Islamic Philosophy. Jack felt his gut tighten ever so slightly. Amid the clutter was a laptop computer with a screensaver showing photographs of an attractive Arab woman and three small boys. "Faisal, this is my friend Jack." "Assalamu alaikum," Faisal said, and they shook hands, each man assessing the other. Jack wanted to trust him and fighting the sense that he shouldn't. He supposed it all boiled down to whether or not this young man's idea of Islamic philosophy was similar to Al-Fida's and included killing in the name of Allah. Sarah had assured Jack that Faisal wasn't a radical, but then Sarah herself had spent nearly a year pretending to be something she wasn't, as had Abdal and God knew how many others. Jack was still trying to adjust to the fact that there was a president of the United States with a middle name Hussein. Who was to say this guy wasn't pretending as well? Faisal gestured to the sofa. "Sit, please. Now, let me pause. You've got to understand I'm a very political man, so even my fiction is somewhat political." Faisal gestured to the sofa. Sit, please. They sat and Faisal took a chair opposite them. Sarah leaned forward and she explains to him what he wants him to do. He's a computer expert, okay? And she says to him, look, we have to be truthful with each other. Yes, of course, Islam teaches us to strive always to excel in virtue and truth, but you're starting to frighten me. It's a frightening world, Jack said unhelpfully, but it had to be said. Everyone was a soldier for one side or the other, whether they liked it or not. Sarah reached into her pocket and pulled out the USB key. This, she told him, there are some encrypted emails on it that I'm hoping you can crack. Me? I know how talented you are, Faisal. I know you've helped some of the teachers with their computers, other students, and I know codes are one of your hobbies. I remember it from the essay in your application packet. He shrugged. I know a few things. He looked at the key suspiciously. Who do these emails belong to? Sarah fixed those beautiful but firm eyes on the young man. Have you ever heard of a group called the Hand of Allah? His expression became restless, anxious. It was obvious he had. Now you truly are frightening me. Why are you involved in? What are you involved in? Trying to stop them, she said frankly. Jack was watching the young man's face carefully. Nothing changed. That was a good sign. There was no, aha, I've got you. You've fallen into a Hand of Allah trap. We believe the emails come from a member of that group, Sarah went on. Someone high within the Home Secretary's office. What? Faisal exclaimed. That's absurd. And why would you have them?
Severed.
Iran, the mullahs, building nuclear weapons. The Obama administration is doing nothing about it. Iran's supreme leader says kill all the Jews, annihilate Israel. Obama does nothing about it. Well, what should the administration be doing? And will Israel attack Iran this summer, like some rumors are reporting? Joining us right now on the Savage Nation to give us his opinion is Eric Stackelback, a terrorism and national security analyst for CBN News. Eric Stackelback, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Michael, it's great to talk to you.
So, Eric, is the administration doing anything at all to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon?
Well, Michael, they seem to think that diplomacy, dialogue, sanctions will stop the genocidal apocalyptic mullahs from acquiring nuclear weapons. You and I have talked about this many times, Michael. It's not going to work. Look, sanctions right now, and by the way, it took President Obama months and months and months to put any kind of meaningful sanctions in place against Iran, and they don't even kick in for another several months. So look, at the end of the day, sanctions are hurting Iran. Economically, they're squeezing Iran a bit economically, without a doubt, especially sanctions out of Europe. France and Canada, and this is very telling, have tougher sanctions against Iran than us, which is an embarrassment. So they're squeezing Iran a bit. They're squeezing the Iranian economy. But the Iranians, two things here, Michael. Number one, Ahmadinejad, and especially the supreme leader, Khamenei, he just said last week, sanctions, and I quote, sanctions will not stop us. Sanctions will not stop our nuclear weapons program. That's the first thing. So they're telling us, look, it ain't going to work. You can sanction us all you want. We're going to continue this drive. It's our divine right from Allah to have nuclear weapons. But number two, Michael, and this is a key thing here that I have not heard discussed enough. Okay, Iran is being pushed against the wall by sanctions. What is Iran's MO when their backs are against the wall? Their MO is to lash out. I think Iran, everyone's talking about Israel striking Iran's nuclear facilities. And I think that is going to happen probably, not definitely, but probably this year. But here's something for you. What if Iran strikes first? What if Iran preemptively starts, say, a proxy war on Israel's borders like they've done in the past through Hezbollah, through Hamas, possibly even through Syria? Or what if Iran carries out a terror attack on U.S. soil? We just had the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, last week, who's usually not the brightest guy, but in this case he was correct. We had him testifying before Congress and saying, look, we believe, does the U.S. intelligence community, that Iran may be planning terror attacks on U.S. soil in the future, in the coming weeks, months. So we could have Iran preempt everybody and strike first. And the big question then is, What does Obama do? Does he have a Jimmy Carter-type moment? It looks like that's the most likely outcome right now.
Well, what should the administration be doing to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons, short of going to war?
You know, Michael, at the end of the day, it's an unsavory option, but it's the only option left. Let's lay all the cards on the table. Let's stop mincing words. The only thing that will stop Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons is a military strike against their nuclear facilities. That's the bottom line. Everyone from the UN to Israeli intelligence to U.S. intelligence, they're all saying the same thing. Iran will have a bomb within a year. Leon Panetta, the defense secretary who again and again has encouraged Israel not to strike, even he said last weekend that, yes, Iran may very well be able to build a nuclear bomb by the end of this year. So it's coming. We know they already have. And the UN, of all places, has said that Iran right now has enough enriched uranium to produce 4 bombs. And now we know they've sped up their uranium enrichment program deep in these underground bunkers. So it's approaching 0 hour. I can tell you the Israelis, judging by Israeli leader statements, they're swiftly losing patience. And it's moving towards decision time. What the U.S. should do, we should strike those nuclear facilities, and we should encourage regime change in Iran to end this threat once and for all. The Iranians have been at war with us for 32 years. This Iranian threat is not just an Israeli problem. This is a problem for the world. It's an existential threat to America as well. It was no coincidence, Michael, that recently it was revealed that Iran is working on intercontinental ballistic missiles that can reach the east coast of the United States. That is not a coincidence. And it's also not a coincidence that Iran and Hezbollah, as you and I have discussed here on the show, Michael, are establishing a network throughout Latin America at our very doorstep. They've opened 6 new embassies in Latin America in the past 5 years. It's also not a coincidence that Ahmadinejad visited Cuba last month on his tour through Latin America. They're trying to establish a forward base there to attack the United States. So this is an existential threat to America. Remember, we are the great Satan. Israel is only the little Satan. We should act once and for all to eliminate this threat, along with Europe, along with NATO. But we will not, Michael, unless, as I said, unless we are attacked first by Iran and Obama is forced to respond. Say Iran shuts down the Strait of Hormuz. Say Iran hits us with a terror attack and Obama is forced to respond in an election year. I don't see the U.S. doing anything, and I see this being left, this dirty job, once again, being left to the Israelis.
Well, do you think Israel is going to attack Iran, and do you fear it will cause a third world war?
You have the real possibility when I believe it's a win scenario. As I said, unless the U.S. is struck first by Iran and we're forced to respond under Obama, I don't see Obama acting, especially in an election year. Mr. No Drama Obama, the last thing he wants is a Middle East war in an election year. So when Israel strikes, could it spark a third world war? Look, I tend to think it's going to spark probably major chaos in the Middle East. I don't necessarily know that it will pull everyone in and you'll have a third world war, but you will have a major Middle East war in the very least. It could get bigger. Look, Russia has made clear that they do not want Iran to be hit. Russia has thrown in its lot with Iran. They're an ally of Iran. They helped Iran build one of those nuclear reactors. Russia will be fuming if it happens. I tend to think, though, Michael, that this will probably provoke a more limited engagement in the Middle East. The U.S. might get pulled in. Look, if Iran, after Israel hits those nuclear facilities, when Iran retaliates, and they will retaliate, if they shut down the Strait of Hormuz, if they attack U.S. troops in Iraq, in Afghanistan, if they carry out a terror attack against American targets, then yes, you will probably see the U.S. get involved. But in the very least, you'll have oil and gas prices will skyrocket no matter what. They're going to go up. We know that. Strait of Hormuz, the Iranians might try and shut it down, probably will try and shut it down. Of course, they will react through their proxies, Hezbollah, Hamas, on Israel's borders. So it's going to get nasty, without a doubt. And they will also, the Iranians themselves, will fire missiles at Israel. And I think the wild card here, Michael, is Syria. What does Syria do? They have the largest chemical weapons stockpile in the Middle East. They've been saber-rattling over the past few months. Assad is desperate to hang on to power. And look, he's talked about if things get really out of hand, we'll turn our fury on the Zionist entity. That's how the Syrians look at it. So it's going to get nasty. But when I talk to Israeli officials, they have a confidence that they can pull this off with limited casualties. They say, look, we might have 500 people killed, which is horrible, especially in a small country like Israel. But, you know, you're hearing these doomsday scenarios about the Iranian retaliation. It almost reminds you of back in the first Gulf War, Michael, the mother of all battles, when Saddam was talking about the fierce retaliation. We're going to leave the battlefield littered with American corpses. Well, the Iranians are doing similar saber rattling right now. Don't get me wrong. The Iranians are extremely dangerous. They're entrenched, as I said, even in the Western Hemisphere. Extremely, extremely dangerous. But when you talk to Israeli officials, they seem confident that they can weather this storm. They know it's going to be nasty, but that they can weather the military storm. I think maybe perhaps even one of the bigger things here, Michael, is the diplomatic storm that's going to follow. You're going to have world condemnation of Israel. Oh, Europe, the UN, Russia, China, everyone is going to pile on. And if Israel does it this year, 2012, okay, what does Obama do? Now, Obama, I would think, in an election year, will grit his teeth, force a smile, bite his tongue, and support Israel, at least publicly. Because it's an election year, if he comes out fiercely against Israel in a time of war, no less, close to the election, it's really going to hurt him. It's really going to hurt him. But if Israel waited till after the election, I think it would be a major mistake, because you'll have an emboldened Obama who's not worried about getting reelected, who can vent his full fury on Israel in 2013 if they waited. So that's the main thing that makes me tend to think that Israel is going to do it this year before the election. Who knows? Maybe I'm completely wrong. Maybe Israel won't do it at all. But, Michael, I look at history real quick. When existential threats have gathered against Israel, whether 1967 with the Six-Day War, 1981 with the Iraqi nuclear reactor at Osirik, or 2007 when the Syrians were building a nuclear reactor, on each of those occasions, when faced with an existential threat by its neighbors, Israel preemptively struck. I don't see why Iran, which is a bigger danger than any of those previous three, would be any different.
I don't think this whole situation with Iran could be handled without military force. Do you?
You know, Michael, at the end of the day, I'm sad to say, unless we have regime change in Iran, I think this is spiraling towards military confrontation. Or as Ahmadinejad said, look, our nuclear program, Iran's nuclear program, is, quote, like a train with no brakes. That's what Ahmadinejad said. They're not going to back down. They're not going to yield unless you change the regime. And, Michael, all of our dream and our hope is that we could change the Iranian regime organically from within. The Iranian people rise up. Boom. They overthrow the mullahs. We have a new regime that's friendly to the West. That's everyone's dream. And, you know, in June 2009, we had a possibility of that when you had a million Iranians in the streets protesting this regime. They were on the ropes. What does President Obama do? Not tear down this wall. No. He says, we don't want to meddle. And I quote, we don't want to be seen as meddling. We missed a golden opportunity there. And the regime has tightened the grip since then in the past 2.5 years. So regime change, that's everyone's ultimate dream for Iran. I don't know how close it is right now, to be honest. And hopefully, hey, if there is a military strike against Iran's facilities, it sends the regime into disarray, chaos, then maybe once again we'll see the Iranian people rise up. Maybe we could see that regime change. We ultimately need regime change. I don't know that it's going to come in time, and that's the big problem. I think we're absolutely spiraling towards a military confrontation. Israel cannot wait much longer. Israel, look, the Iranians have said Israel is a one-bomb country. The bottom line is, if Iran, if this regime, this apocalyptic regime with this apocalyptic ideology, if they get the bomb, they will use it. I take them at their word. They will use it. They will use it. And Israel can't afford, obviously, with the history of the Jewish people especially, to wait around and wait for an existential threat to manifest itself. They can't do it. Once Iran has the bomb, does a nuclear test, it's too late. And I think we're going to wake up one morning, if not this year, next year, Michael, and you want to flip on Fox or CNN or whatever, and you're going to see one of two things. You're either going to see that Israeli jets are in the air. They're attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. Where you're going to see that Iran has just tested a nuclear bomb successfully. I think you're going to see one of two things. One last thing I'd say here, Michael, I wouldn't underestimate Israel's abilities on the scientific, technological realm when it comes to striking Iran's nuclear facilities. I think Israel has some tricks up their sleeve on the technological front. They're pretty cutting edge in terms of electronic warfare, in terms of cyber warfare. So I think this military strike, if it comes, could be a bit unorthodox in a lot of ways. So it's going to be fascinating to see it play out.
Eric Stackelbeck, thanks for joining us today on the Savage Nation.
Michael, always a pleasure. You can check out more at my blog, Stackelbeck on Terror, at cbnnews.com. Also, check out my book. We talk a lot about Iran in it. It's called The Terrorist Next Door, How the Government is Deceiving You About the Islamist Threat. Thanks again.
I'm Michael Savage. We'll be right back.
Savage.
Shalt not oppress thy neighbor, nor rob him. The wages of a hired servant shall not abide with thee all night until the morning. Thou shalt not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind, but thou shalt fear thy God. I am the Lord. See, this is all in Leviticus. And it sounds good. I mean, the no stumbling block stuff and paying the guy who works for you. I like that. But if you actually read on in Leviticus, it's really frightening. You talk about fire and brimstone. You talk about killing and murder. It's all in here. I mean, this book is filled with murder. They kill everybody. They even kill people who divine. In other words, if you meet some... Look at this one. You shall not eat... You shall not practice divination, nor soothsaying. And if a stranger... Which is this one here? And if you cut your hair off, also no good. You got a tattoo, no good. Where is this in Leviticus? Is it the page before it? It's really awful stuff. It's filled with a lot of nakedness, too. Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of a woman and her daughter. Thou shalt not take her son's daughter or her daughter's daughter to uncover her nakedness. They are near kinswomen. It is a lewdness. And thou shalt not take a woman to her sister to be a rival to her to uncover her nakedness beside the other in her lifetime. In other words, you can't marry the sister. And thou shalt not approach unto a woman to uncover her nakedness as long as she is impure by her uncleanness. And thou shalt not lie carnally with thy neighbor's wife to defile thyself with her. Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is an abomination. And thou shalt not lie with any beast to defile thyself therewith. Neither shall any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereto. It is perversion. Now, you've got to understand that. I mean, this is from 5,000 years ago. We know that this doesn't apply in San Francisco or in New York or in Austin, Texas. In fact, the opposite is true. If anyone would actually quote this, they would be called every name under the sun as they are today. So you've got to ask yourself, which part of the Bible do you accept and which part don't you accept? Where does modern religion begin and antiquated religion end? It's pretty heavy-duty stuff. And that's what makes people crazy, is that when they start reading this stuff, they don't know, well, wait a minute, how much of this should I believe? How much should I not believe? How much of this is the word of God? How much is it the word of man? How much is it the word of ancient Israelites who were low on vitamin B3 and were just suffering from sun blindness? You know, they don't know. I mean, you could say all of it's God's word, the Old Testament, the five books of Moses, so to speak. And then you could follow it fanatically and you wind up Mel Gibson. Or, I'm saying you don't know where to begin and end with it. But it's pretty heavy-duty stuff. So eventually, so you say, oh, I don't believe in any of it. So I strip it all away to become a schmuck on television who's high all the time on marijuana, who then poses as a man who hates God and hates religion. That's the other side of the extreme. A man who thinks he's a wise guy because he hates God and he hates religion. He thinks that makes him sophisticated and cool. So I understand how hard it is to walk the walk in this earth, to not harm others or harm yourself and not be a drug addict. It's very difficult. And it's a very difficult thing for a person who is not overtly religious, by the way, because a religious person has the religion to the rules to follow, the roadmap. He has the geographic plan. The person who eschews religion, doesn't believe in God, and is still a good person, has possibly the hardest road because he doesn't even have a roadmap other than one guiding star, and that is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And I've traveled, I mean, personally, we're getting into religion again. I didn't mean to go there, but I knew it would go there anyway. I've been around. I've traveled a lot. I've met a lot of people from all walks of life, different religions, races, as you have. We're living in that world today. It's nothing unique. And at the end of the day, all religions come down to one edict. One, only one. I mean, if it's a decent religion, not a fanatical, insane religion, it all comes down to one set of rules. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. If you follow that, basically you're a good person. And if you follow the rituals of a religion and you don't follow that, then you're a piece of refuse. And I have met religious people with all the garb and with all the mumbo jumbo, with the touching and the costumes, and they're the biggest crooks on the planet. I met them all. Okay, so don't tell me that just because you're religious, you're good, or because if you're not religious, you're bad. Let's grow up already.
Savage.